From KUER.
This is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you see someone barking into a cell phone at the table next to you at dinner, it's hard not to think manners in the Western world have reached an all-time low. In his book on manners, the writer Henry Alford lists the theories that people have offered for the death of civility. It was the 60s. It was the rise of celebrity culture. It was TV dinners or tight pants. Well, TV dinners are a problem, of course, but Alford doesn't really think that everything's going to heck in a handbasket. He says good manners are probably on the upswing, in fact. But every day, he says, we're faced with the challenges of trying to be civil in an age saturated with distractions. Alford's book is a journey to understand manners and what they look like in our day and age. And he's joining us today to tell us what he's learned. His book is called, Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the writer Henry Alford, there was a kind of clincher moment that led him to write a book about manners in the modern world. We'll get to that in a moment. But what really got him thinking about the subject was something he read by the philosopher Edmund Burke, that manners are more important than laws. And Alford believes it. His book examines what good manners look like or should look like in our day and age, and he takes on cell phone etiquette and email etiquette. But this is not a rule book. In his book, Alford writes that at the end of each day, his life is far more affected by the small indignities or the tiny acts of grace than by any piece of policy or legislation. His book is called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And today in the program, Henry Alford is joining us to talk about it. Henry Alford has written for The New York Times, for The New Yorker, for Vanity Fair. He's the author of several books of what's been called investigative humor, including How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They're Still on This Earth. He joins us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Henry Alford, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, I guess let's start first about what got you thinking about all of this. I mentioned the Edmund Burke quote, the idea of manners being more important than laws. But what about that? I mean, what sort of struck you about that, that got you thinking about the way we behave?
Well, I think that humans are largely emotional beings rather than intellectual beings. Perhaps I'm generalizing, starting with the self. But yeah, definitely at the end of each day, my mind is humming with the fact that someone hasn't returned my email in 4 days. Yeah. It's not thrumming with a recent governmental policy. And yeah, I think that's just – that's very natural and human that we that the things that seem to be very small are in fact large and have these huge repercussions for us.
So let me ask about that clincher moment, which I sort of referenced. Talk about that. This happens at a grocery store and it kind of gets you going on this kind of what did you call it? Reverse etiquette crusade, I guess it
was.
The
horror. The horror. I can't believe you're making me talk about it. No. Every book has a creation myth.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say that mine is not a myth. This actually happened. Simply that I was at a grocery store in downtown Manhattan, where I live, and the young gal behind the cash register dropped my apple on the floor and then reached down, picked it up, put it in the bag, and said nothing.
Yeah.
And so I decided I'm going to do something I call reverse apologizing. So I said to her, oh, I'm sorry. And she said nothing.
Yeah.
And so then I said, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean for you to drop my apple like that.
Yeah.
At which point, she stared off into the mid-distance as if receiving instructions from outer space. It was very, just no reaction whatsoever. And this prompted a 6-week campaign where whenever someone owed me an apology, I would say it out loud for them.
Right. And I love the part where there's a guy in Sixth Avenue who bumps into you, or his duffel bag bumps into you anyway. And it's funny because as the time sort of goes, you get more and more explicit or...
Well, yeah, because people didn't get it.
Because no one's getting it, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like this sort of deadpan, ironical thing. And they, yeah, it's just, it's totally, it was totally lost on them. So finally I realized I've got to, you know, spell it out for these folks. So yes, when that guy banged into me with his duffel bag, I apologize. And seeing that that no response was forthcoming, I said, I'm saying what you should be saying. It was like, and finally, the dimmest possible light bulb went off over his head. And yeah, that. So once I started getting explicit, then it did actually start working in my favor.
But the thing that's interesting, though, is that the idea is to kind of this little exercise you do, which is to kind of confer this epiphany on these people. Like, I'm going to sort of just I'll take you there, and then you're going to realize you should say this certain thing. But
yeah,
but no one does, or not very many people do. I mean, you finally get someone who says, wow, I'll think about it. This great rant you have with a woman who bumps into you with her stroller. And it sort of makes me wonder what your expectations were for the book then. I mean, you're as explicit as you can be. What are you hoping with the book?
Well, it's true. I mean, I would love to change the world. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. I think that it would be naive for me to think that I'm going to change the world in a huge way. But I think that I can change a lot of little things, a lot of things that irritate people or that hurt people's feelings. And ultimately, to me, that's what manners are about. I would never in a million years argue for formality for formality's sake. What I'm, you know, the whole point is I'm trying to keep us from hurting one another's feelings.
I wonder if you worry just a little that in these conversations that you're going to be doing or the interviews that you're going to be doing, that you're going to hear, you know, that kind of endless inventory of gripes and offenses, the kind of rants about the bad behavior of others, which I have to say is not really what your book is about.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, it's true. And it's really shooting fish in a barrel. I did not want to write a book about, you know, the person on the train or, you know, on the public transportation who's talking on their cell phone too loudly. You know, there's certain, albeit, you know, egregious bad manners that are just too easy, and we've heard too much about them. I really did try to go out of my way to find things that we do unintentionally and to find bad manners that we're not talking about but should be.
So let's define our terms, because you asked this question in the book. What exactly are good manners? And you say, I guess it's easier to say what bad manners are, but what are good manners, bad manners? How do you define it?
It's really tricky. Well, I would say, you know, bad manners are anything that makes you feel, you know, more like a wet-lipped monkey than you actually are. So anything that's putting you in your place or demeaning you. Good manners is trickier. I do right up front in the book, I do delineate between manners and etiquette and protocol, because I feel like those are terms that get thrown around interchangeably. By manners, I mean principles, do unto others. Smaller than that is etiquette, and I think etiquette are the specific acts of those principles, like... offer to give anyone around you a ride home. And then protocol is a subset of etiquette, and that's etiquette that's very specific to a certain location. So that would be, you know, offer to give everyone a ride home and be sure to ask before 7 p.m. because that's when the last train leaves.
You say in the book that part of this was, you know, the idea is holding up a magnifying glass to the bad manners of others, including yourself. And so where do you figure you are? I mean, you wrote the book about all of this, so you must have a pretty, you know, high level of sensitivity about all of this and probably decent manners. But it's one of the points you make that is we almost never see our own bad manners.
No, exactly. That's the whole thing, is that, you know, bad manners are something that someone else has. We can always rationalize our own behavior. You know, I didn't get too much sleep last night. Oh, God, I'm sorry. I was in a rush. I wasn't thinking, yada, yada, yada. But no, in fact, a lot of bad manners that are being perpetrated today are being perpetrated by people like you and me. And I think that I'm really glad that you picked up on that in the book, because, no, I think that's sort of the first step to raising the level of manners in the country, is that we need to cop to our own shortcomings. Yeah, if you met me for an hour, even for a couple of days, you would come away thinking, oh, he's a pretty lovely guy. But in fact, I have a lot of things that I do, some unintentionally, some intentionally, that that I think, yeah, could easily be defined as bad manners. And I would imagine that's the case for most people.
Mm. I kept wondering if there was, you know, one character trait that you have to possess to have decent manners. I mean, I keep thinking of self-awareness, or at least a good sense of awareness about, you know, others in the world around you. Is there one thing? Is it do some of us have it and some of us don't?
Well, yeah, it's true. There, awareness comes to mind. By the end of the book, what I really, the word that I kept using was imagination.
Yeah.
That it's this idea of being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes, regardless of your own situation. There's a great Samuel Johnson phrase where he refers to good manners as fictitious benevolence.
Yeah.
And I think that really gets at it, that good manners, you know, that I think that in our country, where the prevailing ethos is do what makes you feel comfortable,
right.
Do what's going to make everyone in the room feel comfortable. Well, frankly, comfortable is not such a pretty picture. You know, my comfortable is underpants and a box of frozen waffles.
Right.
And so I think if we all operate at that level, it's not going to work. And that's where this fictitious benevolence comes in, is as soon as you leave your home, you have to realize that to a certain extent, there's a little bit of fiction that you have to enact.
Mm.
There's a little bit of yourself that you have to suspend whenever you come in contact with other people.
You talk about it as, you know, it requires this constant calibration. We have to keep kind of reworking it in the context of the moment. And one thing that was interesting is it's less about how we treat those closest to us, it seems, in some ways, though of course that's important. But really, a lot of this is how we deal with strangers, which you talk about means you kind of have to suspend, as you put it, some part of ourselves.
Yeah, no, and you can even see that historically. Look at something like, you know, there was a huge efflorescence of interest in etiquette guides in the first two decades of the 19th century, and that's very specifically tied to the influx of people to the cities, to large urban areas. So, yes, part of it was that people wanted to read these etiquette guides in order to know how to get ahead, but there's also this idea that they were, you know, it was a time in their lives when they were confronted by strangers constantly, and that's really when you need manners, because you know how your family and how the people in your village are going to react if you spit on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. You don't know how a total stranger from the other side of the world is going to react. So, yeah, I think that the story of manners is largely the story of interacting with people that you don't know.
The question comes up in the book too. You know, I think there's this kind of inclination to think that because we're seeing more and more people, you know, barking away into cell phones at grocery stores and restaurants, that we're ruder now than we have ever been as a society. And you talk about in the book that you hear that from a lot of people, you know, social critics, that, all right, we're at the bottom, you know. But you don't really believe that.
I don't, because, you know, well, there are two things. One is, look at it. If you look at it historically, compare the behavior that we engage in today with, say, anything that happened in a medieval tavern.
Right.
And we're looking real good by comparison. So I think, yeah, if you take the long view, no, I don't think we can say manners have gotten worse. The other one is, you know, historically, there have been two kinds of manners. One is morals writ in miniature.
Yep.
That would be like, you know, wait to start talking before the other person stops talking. And then the other kind is codes of behavior meant to exclude others. So that would be like, you know, speaking German when not everyone in the room speaks German. I think that in today's society, we really traffic more in the former category of manners, that it's much more about morals writ small. And I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, call me Pollyanna, but I do think that we live in a pretty egalitarian culture. And I think that political correctness, despite its occasional embarrassing excesses, that it really has raised the level of everyday decorum.
You say in the book, Americans have, I think you put an essential conflict with manners.
Yeah, don't you? I think that as soon as you say manners, people think elitism.
Yeah, or fustiness or something.
Yeah. Asparagus forks.
Yeah.
Little pinky thing. Yeah. Things with your pinkies. which is idiotic. Because manners are, you know, should be practiced irrespective of any socioeconomic factors. Mm. You know, they're available to anyone. And I do think that that possibly that elitist tang, that might be a holdover of this. You know, I was talking about the flowering of interest in etiquette guides in the 19th century, because a lot of those people were trying to get ahead. There was a kind of a fascination with, you know, what are the richies doing up on the hill? I want to go up on the hill and have dinner. And yeah, I think there's a little bit of that left over.
So it's not about just being considerate. It's about, you use this word, esteem. Esteem and respect, that comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. The quality that is practiced by noted speller Aretha Franklin.
Right.
I do think it's about respect and, to me, the story of modern manners is really about that manners aren't getting worse, as I've said, but I do think that they're getting more and more relative. My impression is that every day it's almost as if you're walking through a series of they're almost like microclimates.
Yeah.
That each little enclave of people or each milieu sort of has its own rules. Look at something like talking on a cell phone in public. Mm. Typically, I think that's a really rude gesture. If I'm talking with a friend and he or she whips out the cell phone, that irks me. But that is not the case if the person I'm talking with is a working mommy, you know, because she's putting out a lot of fires. She's got a lifeline to her little kid. So that's totally different. But then what if you are with a single friend and you go to a bar and she runs into that guy she's been on two dates with, then suddenly it might be very cool for me to pretend that my cell phone has rung in order to give the two lovebirds some space. So, yeah, there are three situations where the rules are changing. And so I think today, good manners are not about learning a list of do's and don'ts,
right.
But it's about being able to enter any situation and look for clues.
Henry Alford is with us. His book is called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West at KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what manners look like in our day and age, like taking a call at a restaurant or saying no problem when someone says thank you. The writer Henry Alford is our guest today. He's written a book that explores manners and etiquette, I suppose, in the 21st century. His book is called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. Henry Alford, I want to ask you about your journey to Japan. Talk about why you went there, because you say in the book that Japan is the Fort Knox of the World Manners Reserve.
Yes. Well, I figured that it would be really helpful to go to a culture that puts such a premium on behavior, almost always for good, sometimes for worse. Yeah. Because then when I came back to the United States, I would realize, sort of what kind of value that we put on decorum. I spent 3 weeks in Japan. I had two teachers. One was a formal teacher who sort of ran me through the gamut of using chopsticks in restaurants and greeting people and what have you. And then another guy was, the other teacher was totally self-elected. Right next to the fish market, there are these series of kind of shacks in which you can get the most amazing fresh sushi. And this one waiter, probably about 35 years old, wearing a leather vest with lots of leather lanyards coming off it, and keys and little tiny fingernail clippers. His look was very sort of gay ski lift operator.
Right.
So this dude, I walk into his restaurant, and the first thing, right off the bat, he hands me a mimeograph with all these phrases like onegai shimazu and hold bowl of rice close to mouth, so that you don't spill your rice. All these instructions and phrases. And he deals with so many clueless foreigners that he's now taken upon himself to hand out these mimeographs.
It's interesting that you write about the rules that you learn from both the teacher, no eating or drinking on the subway and no phone calls on the subway. There are rules about slippers and pointing and, eye contact. But it seems like all of this is kind of built around this pretty intense social pressure.
Yeah, no, precisely. And as one person explained to me, he said, I would never eat on the subway because that would say something bad about Japanese people.
Yeah.
So that he sees himself not just as one person in society, but he sees himself as a whole community of people. That by putting forth this definition of what a Japanese person is, that he's going to either taint or embellish everyone who lives with him.
Mm. And it's interesting that a lot of this kind of polite behavior that you found in Japan seemed to be grounded in the idea, as one of your teachers put it, the idea of saving face. That seemed another kind of important lesson that you brought back.
Right. And I don't, that's not a worldview that I what that I love, but I think it's very honest.
Yeah.
I also have this thing about I think that every day we inherit the toilet seat, as I call it, which is to say that every time you walk out of a single commode public facility, that people are going to assume that whatever the state of the toilet seat is your doing.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not you just went into the bathroom to comb your hair. So my feeling is, give the seat a little wipe. It's only going to take you 3 seconds, and you're going to feel a whole lot better. And I think when I first had that idea, yes, it was this idea about escaping humiliation, about saving face. And I think that's where I started out. That's where I start out in the book, yeah, psychologically. But gradually, I think that if that's all you've got going, fine.
Sure.
That's enough. Maybe that will keep you from being a jerk. I know it's helped me a lot over the years. But ideally, for those of us who are enlightened, you're listening to NPR, that hopefully you can do just a little bit better,
yeah,
a little bit better than trying to escape humiliation.
Well, and we'll get to this toward the end of the program, but the way you evolve and the way you're thinking about all of this, I mean, you get in the end, you start thinking about it less as just sort of courtesies as much as an act of altruism, and we'll talk about that. Let's go to the phones. Lisa is with us. She's in Bountiful, Utah. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Listen, I was on a trip not long ago to England, and I took my 12-year-old son with me. And when we were on the subway, it was almost like being in church. It was so quiet. Everybody was self-contained. Nobody bothered anybody. Everybody was appropriate. It was kind of an interesting dichotomy or difference from subways here in the United States.
Well, it's interesting, Henry Alford. You talk about the I guess there are those cultural differences, and of course your home base is New York. There's the etiquette on New York subways and by New Yorkers themselves. You write about that's an interesting sort of contrast, I guess.
Oh yeah, talk about manners that are specific to a certain location. Well, in New York, it's very common that someone will ask you how many square feet is your home and how much did you pay for it?
Yeah.
That's not considered rude. It comes out of a feeling of commiseration, the subtext is we're all being screwed, so let's share our wounds together. As Lisa was saying, this sort of church-like behavior on the train, I've encountered that in Europe as well. I don't see that so much in the United States. Even in the quiet car on Amtrak, I don't know. I sometimes come up against a certain sanctimoniousness. Whereas, in certain European countries, it feels like it's almost a given that you're gonna be quiet and contained on a train.
Lisa, glad you called. Thanks very much. Back to the phones. Eric is with us in Salt Lake City. Eric, hi.
Hi, thank you for allowing me to be on your show.
Sure.
I was just wanting to bring up, I was brought up in the Depression era with a West Virginia coal miner father, and we recently on Black Friday, when we had a new baby boy and had been married for 10 years, had never seen any cultural or etiquette differences between my wife and I. And with new in-laws of course, actually with the family, we saw some severe fault lines actually of imposing time on privacy and personal space and time where some of her in-laws actually stayed and overstayed as house guests longer than actually than they were welcome.
Yeah.
Oh.
I wanted to ask you that, which kind of leads me to something you learned from Miss Manners of all people. And it was just kind of a reference you made about the kind of the origins of hospitality that you get in the country south. You want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, simply that much to most people's surprise that many of those manners that we think of as being quintessentially Southern, like calling people y'all or calling people brother and sister, that a lot of those wonderful little turns of civility from the South, they actually came to us through through slaves, because what happened often on plantations was that these rich plantation owners would leave their kids with the house slaves, many of whom were nobility from their tribes. And so a lot of the kids grew up having learned their manners from their mammy who was there teaching them all along.
It just, I think Eric's call sort of raised that question of the way these manners are, as you've already said, culturally distinct, and people have different, I guess, different rules for even
yeah.
here.
And it's really tricky with house guests. I almost feel like the best thing in those situations is to have some ground rules that you set up front. Email, despite having lots of terrible disadvantages, I think one lovely advantage is that you can do that group email up front and just say, here's what we like to do when we have people stay with us. We like to put a 3-night cap on it. We like to be really quiet until 10 a.m. We like to blah, 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 yeah. like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you can do it by email or in person. In person is lovely, too. Just usually these family get-togethers happen by email. And then I think that... it's just a question of kind of checking in with one another. Mm. You know, if while you're laying down the law, if you want to self-deprecate, I think that's wonderful. That happens to be my own preferred method. I will say, I know I'm being totally neurotic. Please forgive me, but I love to read the to drink my coffee and read the paper and in total silence until 9 a.m. And if you have those kinds of caveats, then stick them in that email with some self-deprecation, and I think it's going to help a lot.
You have a kind of a list of manner questions or manner issues, and I wanted to go through some of these. Where did the no problem response come from, do you figure? I mean, when did people start saying no problem as a substitute for you're welcome?
That one is huge.
Yeah, me too.
I had no idea. Where doesn't that one come from?
Yeah.
No, it's simply that people now use the expression no problem in the weirdest ways. I mean, to me, it almost sounds hostile sometimes. I had a waiter last week who asked me, would you like some more water, sir? And I said, no, thanks. And he said, no problem. Hmm. And I sort of thought, oh, okay. So for you to stand there and do nothing, that's not a problem. Oh, okay. Because I've been trying to think of things for you to do ever since I walked in here. Or a couple months ago, I wrote an email to a friend that said, hey, great running into you last night. So sorry I couldn't swing by your place afterwards. And the response comes back by email, and the response reads, in entirety, no problem. And again, I had to think, now, why would my coming over to your house be a problem? You know, have I been dandruffing on the guacamole again? What is going on here? You know, I didn't think I was that much of a nuisance. So I think that unless an actual problem has been averted, that a lot of times that expression, it's sort of implied martyrdom. Hmm. It sounds almost like false heroism to me. Use it when there is a problem.
I wonder if this is a Utah thing. I hear a lot when you say to someone, sometimes thank you, but when you say, like, I'm sorry to someone in a store or you're fine. Do you hear that? Oh, you're fine.
Oh, I don't hear that. That's funny. I have heard it, but yeah, I don't hear it very often. You're fine.
Well, it seems like such a meaningless thing to say, which raises the question of the no problem. I mean, do they really mean, oh, that isn't a problem, or is it just some sort of linguistic grunt?
That, it is.
You know
precisely,
what I mean?
I think that's a great phrase for it. I think it's a lack of language that we have, and I think it's a reflex. Another example, I rent an office in a large building, and I called the management company to say, hey, just so you know, there's a pipe on the third floor that's dripping and creating a little puddle on the floor. And the person who answered the phone said, no problem. We'll get right to it. And I said, no problem. Well, actually, it is a problem. And that's why I called.
Yeah. Talk about the match your meat problem, which is related to this sort of communication hierarchy. And I have to say, this is one of the things that I have to own because, there are times when I'll respond to a phone call voicemail with an email or vice versa. And you're saying you've got to sort of match those.
I think so. I think in the communication hierarchy, you've got to match the incoming vehicle or go up.
You've got to
meet it at its level or get more personal. So I think that if you are answering a phone call with an email, you better have a good excuse for that. You've got to be, really under the gun work-wise or crisis-wise or something. Otherwise, I think that people do see that as a slight. Mm. I also have friends who will, if I call or email, sometimes they'll message me on Facebook. And that's very weird for me. It's almost like they're like lifting up a bowl that's lying on the countertop and putting their head under it and saying, let's talk underneath this bowl. it's like, what? Why can't? It just seems weird to me. And in certain instances, I think it can cause offense.
Yeah. Elder pestering.
Elder pestering.
I love it. That was the thing that brought my attention to your book, by the way, the Vanity Fair piece.
Well,
Elder
thank
pestering.
You.
Yeah.
That older folks do not want to be asked, are you feeling okay, more than 7 or 8 times an hour.
Yeah.
That it just at a certain point, it sounds a little bit like a death knell. Similarly, cancer patients, these folks, they do not want to hear you look great with anything approaching frequency.
Yeah.
If you want to say that once, great. But then, it seems like you're tongue-tied and you're blurting.
Theater bitching. I get a lot of that. I see that a lot. Theater bitching.
Oh, do you? Good, because I worried that was a little New York-y.
No. I think it happens in movie theaters too.
Yeah, so that's when you're at a movie theater or a legitimate theater, and at the end of the show, the person sitting behind you, sort of out of the blue, you don't know them, a stranger says to you, wasn't that awful?
Yeah.
And I've had that happen to me when the friend I'm sitting with has paid $60 for the tickets. I've had that happen when the person I'm sitting next to is the spouse of one of the actors in the show. God forbid you're sitting with the playwright or the movie director or what have you. I think just because you and I sat in a darkened room together, that does not give you permission to unload your disapproval on me.
All right, before we head to a break, let me ask you about blot on the landscape.
Remind me what blot on the landscape is.
It's Henry Alford. It's the visible booger.
The visible. Yeah. No wonder I repressed.
Sorry. Yeah.
Wow,
you've repressed it.
I have totally. Yeah, I put that one way back in the deep storage.
But it happens. It happens
it
all the
happens.
Time.
It happens. And of course, if you are close friends with someone, easily enough, you can say, "Hey, you've got something going on there. I think if it's someone you don't know well, one way to do it is to implicate yourself, by which I mean say to the person, you know, grab two Kleenexes and say to the person, apparently you and I both need to wipe our noses. And what you're doing there is you are reducing the sting, and you're removing the humiliation by kind of sharing the misdemeanor with yourself, by implicating right, yourself.
Right. The misdemeanor. Well, it's about bringing yourself into it, right? You're making yourself so they're not alone sitting there with this thing hanging out of their nose.
Yeah. No, and that's, I mean, it's the same thing with that, you know, self-deprecating when sending the email to the in-laws. Yeah, I think that, you know, so much of manners is about tone. And I think that a wonderful arrow to have in your quiver is this kind of is a little bit of self-deprecation, so that it's not, so that if you are lodging a complaint, it doesn't come across as criticism or disapproval, but that, yeah, it's a little bit more of a shared experience. Share the booger. That's what I'm saying.
Share the booger.
Share the booger.
Well, there are a lot more of these, by the way. We're going to move on when we get back from a break, but if you read Henry Alford's book, Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That, you'll find out more about the drugstore restraint, the drop-off, the show business, the faint praise. There's a lot of them and more. Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. Henry Alford is with us. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West and KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Henry Alford. We're talking about his new book, Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. Let's go back to the phones. Jacob is with us in Park City, Utah. Jacob, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess concerning manners, I guess there seems to be kind of an obvious stratification or certain people are just better at following the social code. And I guess my question is, how much of that is it all just taught in the society that you live in, or is any of it kind of innate or natural or objective?
Well, you don't really deal with that in the book, whether it's a biological quirk, Henry Alford, but it's a good question.
It's a great question. Yeah. I bet there's been research done on it. I would imagine that awareness and the ability to pick up clues is largely innate, but that it can be developed, that it can be trained like a muscle. And so I think mostly what this is about is training that muscle, is learning how to enter a lot of different situations and looking for the tiniest little keys to how people behave in that situation. Yeah, and I think that is something that that you can work on, and that probably is something that you're going to teach yourself.
How many of these questions? Oh, Jacob, by the way, thanks. How many of these questions do you figure are reflections of, you know, of just of our day and age? I mean, how many of this is, how much of this is because, you know, we're so distracted by so much technology and so much information? Because you put it this way in the book. You say, when we're drawn into a technological reality, we become inattentionally blind, you say, to the charms of unicycling clowns.
Right. Well, that's a psychological term, inattentional blindness. Yeah. I think that all these forms of new media, what they've done is they've just given us more canvas to paint our bad manners on. I don't think that they are actually making us have worse manners. And I think that a lot of these problems we're talking about, they've been around forever. Just the other day, I was looking at this. There was an Egyptian in the 25th century BC who wrote a book called The Instructions of Ptah Hotep. I'm probably butchering that name. But he has things like instructions about going over to someone's house for dinner and how you should eat whatever they serve you and how you should engage in a lot of eye contact. And this was, again, 25th century BC. So people have been dealing with this stuff forever.
Yeah.
So I think that all this, you know, there are a lot of people who will decry modern manners and say, oh, look at the way that kids are always listening to their iPods, or, you know, look at all these forms of new media. Again, I don't think those are making us worse. It's just another arena for us to bring our very talented way with bad manners.
You do write about how we kind of apply manners to email, and you talk about there being these kind of two main impediments to good online manners, as you put it. There's that incredible ease of the form, and there's the blankness of the tone in emails. Talk about that.
Well, the ease, I think we all know about that, that it is seemingly anonymous, yeah. That because you can't look the other person in the eye, you feel much more free to exhibit your demons. If you've ever worn a Halloween mask, you'll know what I'm talking about. You can be the most mild-mannered person in the world, but as soon as you put that mask on and no one knows who you are anymore, suddenly, the bad urchins come crawling out of you. And then the blankness of tone is, yeah, it's just simply that there is this kind of abruptness to this medium, which, you know, as Marshall McLuhan would say, is very, very cold. And I think that's why people put so many exclamation points in their emails, is, you know, you're just desperate to try to humanize it in any way that you can.
Let's go back to the phones. Johnny is with us in Ogden, Utah. Johnny, hi.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling. For accepting my phone call.
Sure.
Mr. Alford, I really appreciated that comment, that story that you made about your Japanese manner instructor and about how he says that his behavior is a way for him to save face. Because at this day and age with social media, you know, I find there, as a society, we share too much about our own lives, not recognizing that in our network, we not only have friends and family, we also have acquaintances who don't know us very well, and we give that impression to them. And by giving too much detail about our lives, I think it gives a bad impression to other people who we don't know very well. So, and thank you so much for that story. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Johnny. No, I totally agree with you. That's something that I think you can trace in part to reality television, this idea that, you know, if you're sharing your innermost feelings with strangers, that suggests that you don't put a lot of value on those innermost feelings. If you're just handing them out willy-nilly, you know, we do live in a confessional age. You can see it in our literature. You know, look at memoirs. The sort of the raging literary form now is all about divulging. I agree with Johnny that there is this there's this weird desire that Americans have to gush. I see it on Facebook often when young couples are posting a lot of pictures of their newborns, which I think is totally lovely. I absolutely think, you know, people should do that. I just really hope that there's no one in their, you know, their friend base who's having trouble conceiving, because I think that could be really hard.
You know, the book comes around to this idea that you mentioned earlier of imagination And there's the story you tell in the book, which seems, I have to say, kind of outrageous. It was at this Saturday matinee of this performance of a play. Tell that story, if you would, and talk about what you sort of drew from that.
Oh, the actress Tova Feldshuh, who's a really wonderful actress, was doing an off-Broadway play here in New York called Irena's Vow. And a gentleman, a theatergoer, walked in about, I think, 3 or 4 minutes late into the first act. And as he was walking in from the back of the theater, he yelled up to Tova Feldshuh, the star of the show, "Could you hold on for just a minute?" while he was getting his seat. And amazingly, she did.
She did.
Yeah, the show kind of paused for a minute so that this gentleman could sit down.
Which is kind of lovely, kind of amazingly gracious on her. You would not expect that.
Right. No, exactly. Kudos to them. But it's this sort of myopia, or this, it verges on autism to me, on the part of that gentleman, that he's really operating from a partially observant world, and I think that's precisely what we all need to struggle against.
Henry Alford. His book is called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. Henry Alford, thank you very much for the time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.